when I look at leadership, especially leading the people around me within the organization, I think, how can I make them as successful as they can be in their career? Even if that means they're going to be more successful than myself.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Ben Doyle, CISO from TELUS Australia and New Zealand, and today we're discussing purposeful leadership. So Ben, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thank you very much, KB. It's great to be here.
So I want to start with purposeful leadership. What does this mean to you?
So this is something I've sort of picked up this year a little bit in terms of, I guess, myself reaching out and trying to push or act as more of a leadership, I guess, in the community on what do we need to do better as we mature as, cybersecurity professionals. And sort of where I'm going with this is, as CISOs, we are so busy with trying to juggle so many balls, trying to deal with so many demands and potential risks that we don't really spend enough time thinking about or even have enough time to think about how we are as leaders. And I think it's the case of we need to be more mindful and more focused, and that's where I came up sort of with the word purposeful, on being more purposeful on carving out that time to focus on what we have to do to improve ourselves as leaders, to basically set the behaviors, the expectations within our organizations, but I also think as we mature as professionals within our community also, so what are the values for cybersecurity professionals across the whole community, because we are a very young profession and we don't have that many people we can look up to as what is the expectations of leaders when it comes to CISO.
Yeah, great. And yeah, you're so right. You've got a lot of things going on and then it's like, oh, now I've got to think about being the right leader. Would you say that people like yourself are looking to other leaders in other industries to see what sort of good characteristics they have to employ those, or?
I think it will come down to personalities and people's backgrounds. I think one of the difficulties we have is if you look at many CISOs and their career and where they've come from, most of us would have come back from technical careers, and in many cases we've come straight from a technical background where, say, SOC management, things like that, we're very focused on the technical risks and the operational risks, which are very demanding, where, again, even at that level, we don't have time to look at what's going on apart from dealing with whatever the technical risk is, let alone understanding what does leadership mean at that level, because it's so operationally focused. So I don't think in many cases, many of us really look to who else across the broader aspect of leadership, not just within cybersecurity, can we actually look at and, I guess, manage and, I guess, tune our behaviours on as we actually grow as leaders. Also, probably the most clearest aspects would be the leaders within each of our organisations. And I think everyone knows they can come in all shapes and sizes. And unfortunately, sometimes some people can be hit with leaders that in their organisations that aren't great role models.
So when you say aren't great role models, what does that mean for you?
When I think of leadership, and it's something I've been focused on quite a bit, is I guess the bad aspects of leaders, and you think about the type of personalities that can rise to the top sometimes. And some of those personalities in some cases can be very much more about themselves and the competition of getting to the top, and that's how they got to the top. Unfortunately, that doesn't flow onto them being particularly good leaders to their workforce and employees underneath. So I'm very much in terms of when I look at leadership, especially leading the people around me within the organization, is I think one of my primary jobs is how can I make them as successful as they can be in their career, even if that means they're going to be more successful than myself. If you think about some of those other attributes for, I guess, bad leaders who sort of rise to the top because they've competed so well, it's just a natural thing where they wouldn't want someone to compete against themselves. So why would they basically make those underneath themselves more successful than themselves?
Great points. Okay, so you raised something before, which I'm interested to find out more, is certain people, certain personalities rising to the top. Would you say that, look, and you mentioned like bad leaders, et cetera, how do these people sort of get to the top? Because I like to think as well that you somewhat have to be not just a good person, you have to be talented and capable, et cetera. But some of these people, I don't get how they get there though, if they're just, you know, people that just rub people the wrong way. I don't understand that.
It can be hard to understand, but the decisions that come into who rises to the top, a lot of it will come back to, are they seen as delivering? In many cases, if it's an organization that is focused on delivering outcomes, delivering sales, delivering revenue, delivering projects successfully, how they get done may be less focused on in terms of, are they doing the right values within the people they're supposed to be leading? And they're only focused on, I guess, the outcome. And therefore, if they're leading that outcome and it's always successful and they're basically riding on the success of others, then I can see how that can go to the top sometimes.
So would you say, Ben, that people would just turn a blind eye? So just say, for example, you referenced before, if someone's seen as delivering, whether they're a nice bloke or you can have a beer with them, it doesn't matter. Do you think people maybe above them would just say, okay, well, they're delivering, like, who cares? We're just going to shy away from saying anything perhaps because I don't want to rock the boat?
I think there's all aspects of that. So in the end, I guess it comes down to the sort of organization you're in and the cultures and beliefs and values on how many of the type of people of, I guess, bad leadership may rise to the top, which may be performant, which is fine if that's the focus for that culture of that organization. And I guess it's a case of if you're employed and you're working within that organization, it's a decision for yourself on whether you want to grow your career or can grow your career in that type of organization, or you should move to another organization with a better culture.
So do you think this way of operating some of these bad sort of characters that existed there that rise to the top and maybe they're good at delivering, but maybe they're not great leader, would you say this is starting to phase out now or it's still pretty prevalent?
I think you'll get it in any large organization, in any business. Human people are very diverse and you get all sorts of diversity within, I guess, how people act. I think there's an expectation. I think you see that coming through from the ESG type of cultural aspects in terms of social expectations within companies now, I guess, especially in Western companies, if I put it in terms of that the responsibilities where it comes down to diversity, inclusion, environmental aspects, things like that, is going to grow an expectation on, I guess, those non-output driven or revenue driven expectations and more the value-based, I guess, requirements. And I would hope that will drive a better culture in many organizations where they think more broadly about what that culture means.
Do you think people think about what culture means to them though? Because everyone's like, oh, it's about the culture. But what does that really mean? Or what does that mean to you?
I think it's a very hard thing to understand for many people what culture means. And realistically, and I'm very honest about this, is people don't always turn up to work to do a career and grow a career. Yes, there's lots there. Some just turn up to do a job, basically. And their job is to earn their money so they can actually do what they want outside of work. And that's their passion and things like that. I think those that are turning up to work as a career and to develop a career probably more tuned in a little bit more around what does the culture mean to me? What do I want to get out of it? When I think about culture, I think it drives from one aspect is values, how you drive those values and the expected behaviors and how you act on a daily basis and what the organization expects you to do and the behaviors you drive, I think drives the culture of that organization then in terms of what's appropriate, what's not, what will be put up with, what won't be put up with.
So would you say, Ben, as well, from a leadership point of view, you sort of need a bit of both worlds? You need these people that are very driven on in their career, but you also need people who sort of just roll up, do their job, do it well and go home. Do you need a blend of these people?
There is an aspect where you do have to do a blend of these people, I think. I think you need to be conscious of that. There are roles where it's perfectly fine to turn up and just do a job if you're doing that job quite well. So that may be more transactional type work, if you like, rather than the expectation of, I guess, those that are career-driven are probably more likely to stretch themselves a little bit more because they're trying to grow from a personal point of view or a work point of view. And so therefore more interested in trying to grow themselves and therefore get extra tasks and drive change the way they want to change it rather than someone that's turning up and, okay, I've got to do X, you know, I've got to go do so many incidents a day or click on so many incidents. If we bring it back to cybersecurity, I've got to do so much in terms of forensics, but I'm only working, you know, 9 to 5 to do this.
Okay, so I now want to switch gears. I want to focus on how the business speaks and operates conversations by default. So this is something that you said, and I'm curious to know by default and what this means. So walk me through it.
You need to understand how the business talks by default, because as cybersecurity people, we're not speaking the language that the business is speaking on an everyday basis, which is where we get a lot of that disconnect and, I guess, misunderstanding. So obviously, one of the issues we have growing up as a very technical discipline, if you like, is we are so focused, and it comes back to we are so focused trying to deal with the threats on a day-to-day basis and the risks on a day-to-day basis. It's very operational focus. We deal with our technical lingo nonstop. So when we turn around and start talking to the business, by default, because we're doing this pretty much all day, every day, we're not, I guess, purposeful, and using going back to that word, we're not purposeful about the language we choose when we talk to non-technical people in the business, and we use a lot of lingo, which causes confusion, would probably cause uncomfortableness in the executives also, because I think you'll have a bit of no one likes to feel like they're stupid, to use a word. So if they don't understand what someone is talking to them about and talking quite confidently about in technical lingo, they may not actually pull that person up and say, hang on, I don't understand what you're talking about. And rather they would probably do a natural boundary or barrier in terms of belief and, I guess, the value that a technical expert is actually presenting to them.
Definitely hear what you're saying. Would you also say in just any discipline, people are like this? So I'll give you an example. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he, ex-investment banker, talking about M&A, he said something to me and I was like, I don't even know what that means. So do you think that this sort of technical way of speaking, no matter what discipline, whether you're a doctor or a vet or you work in investment banking, there's still an element of that. So when you are speaking to someone that's not in that discipline, people still may be confused, but maybe in cyber, it obviously is quite complex. It's very technical. So do you think that maybe it's just more prominent in our space versus other sort of industries out there?
I don't think it's more prominent. I think we're probably more reflecting on it as being more prominent because we're in the industry. And I totally agree. You talk to nursing, the medical doctors, you talk to telcos, they have their own lingo. I used to be in telco many, many years back, so I know the acronyms in there. I'm in defense industry here in Australia. The lingo from a military point of view is very specific also. I think it's the same problem you have in those sort of technical specialists, and it doesn't change as you go around industries, even culture in some aspects also. I think we need to be understanding that we are doing that, and you need to work out how you can actually structure your language based on who you're talking to.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think, like you said before, coming back to that purposeful, being mindful of, you know, I've got to change the discourse in which I communicate to someone in. Do you think that some people just don't want to do that, though? Like, I don't know whether certain people out there use that to appear more intelligent, perhaps, to someone and be like, haha, I've outsmarted you, like, CFO guy. Do you think there's still an element of that which then comes back to the undertone of the cultural aspect of it?
Like I said, you get all sorts of people out there, and I'm sure there may be some personalities that do that, but I don't think that's how the general population from a cyber profession actually addresses it. I think it's more a case of it goes back to they don't naturally or haven't naturally thought about that, and it's probably because they're in so much demand doing so many other things, they haven't had the mind space to think about that, or they haven't been pulled up on it. So a little bit of experience where they might have been pulled up, and so it's in their front of mind. If you hadn't had that experience, or you've hadn't had the chance to actually think about how you can improve how you talk to your executives or other people, then you probably don't have the mind space to realize it's an issue.
So how do people think about that? So for someone listening to this, they're like, oh, I'm probably a victim of this myself. What do people do, or what do you do that can maybe help other people employ some of your strategies?
I think it's more than mindful, and just be aware is probably the first thing you've got to be aware of. And I still do it. And even though, and if I'm talking to my board or executives, I think I've reduced a lot of the lingo very carefully when I talk to people. And yet I can still get comments saying, I have no idea what you said. but I trust what you're doing. And you're always going to get that. And that's where you probably, if you get that sort of conversation, you should again go back and ask the question on, okay, is there anything there that you didn't understand? So if someone's afraid to, I guess, don't want to be seen as they don't understand, this, you can have a bit on yourself where you say, okay, I know I might have spoken technical. Are there aspects about this you didn't understand? Is there a better way I can explain this? Are you confident in the advice I actually gave you? Then you take it on yourself a little bit because you are coming from that technical lingo space.
So is there anything specific that stands out in terms of phrase or terminology that you use that has really resonated with people that you've sort of noticed over the years?
Very much when I looked at the language and things like that, we come from, I think, because we think of cyber in many cases of attacks. I think by natural evolution, we've used terminology coming out of the military, things like DMZ zones, demilitarized zones, things like packet capture. I hadn't actually thought about it until I actually started writing about it. Why did we use the capture term rather than, you know, a log sync or a storage for packets, which was interesting. Mm. Obviously, we have the default, which is all the viruses and stuff like that came from the health aspects, which I think has worked very well from a consumer point of view, and quarantining, things like that. Other aspects I actually really have liked recently, and I've commented on that when Sean Duca was on the podcast, the concept of backburning of data to reduce what private and sensitive data you may have in case you have a really bad day and you have a compromise. Why aren't we doing that, and the value of doing that when it's compared to backburning for reducing the risk to bushfires or forest fires and that sort of aspects, and trying to get that link and lingo between how you may be describing, I guess, a technical cyber term to business people or even general community, that they can almost build a mental model or a visual idea of the concept you're trying to convey. So from an industrial point of view or a specific industry point of view, from a finance point of view, I like the aspects where an insurance CISO was talking about when he talks about obsolescence and obsolete software or obsolescent systems. When he raises it, he says, we have this many toxic assets, which is a very specific term when you come to finance. And they naturally know how they normally do with toxic assets, whether it's financial assets or, I guess, building assets, so they can apply the same mental logic when it comes to cyber and systems, which I think was actually quite smart.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think what I try to do when I'm speaking to someone is understand what they do and then try to use analogies that I read in your article that I can draw upon that person understands, that it's going to resonate with them, versus talking in abstract terms that someone's like, I don't know what this person's doing. So when I'm speaking about like media or, you know, PR stuff, I then try to create an analogy specific to that person I'm talking to so they understand. And more often than not, it does work. But again, I'm obviously in comms and media, so maybe it's a little bit easier for someone like myself. But again, this is a trained and a learned skill, right? I don't think it's as easy as people think it is.
Yeah, true. And that's where it goes back to that, I guess, the generic purposeful leadership sort of concept. You have to spend the time and you have to spend the focus to improve yourself in that. And I think there's a real value, especially as you said, if you can craft your conversation using the aspects of the person you're talking to in terms of an analogy, then the conversation you bounce back and forth once they explore that analogy to see if they've got the concept correct and how it may apply back into something they don't understand in terms of cyber or technology, that can be a really interesting conversation to actually explore sometimes.
So you're a CISO. So what type of conversations should CISOs be focusing on from your point of view, as you just sort of mentioned before around the word focus? I want to touch on that now.
I guess one of the hardest things we've got to try to do as CISOs, and it's very hard to do because I think the expectations that our organizations and our leadership still have on us from CISO's point of view, is we've got to try to get out of talking about day-to-day operational risks and threats and how we mitigate and the latest vulnerabilities and things like that. If we're talking to the organizations, we can't be talking at that level. But where I say it's hard is there's an expectation from that leadership that our role still is responsible no matter what happens. If we have a compromise, if we have a technical risk, if we have a vulnerability we haven't patched, which hits then a regulatory issue, all aspects of the operation when it comes to protecting the company from a technical threat is still an expectation on the CISO, and it's a direct expectation in many cases, which makes it very hard to shift our language if we have to still spend quite a bit of time in what is really the operational aspects of cybersecurity, when realistically we should be having those conversations, we should be embedded with the business and having the conversation at the business level, the business process level, the project level, the delivery, the strategy sort of concept, so we can actually have the advice to actually give the guidance when it comes to those higher level strategic conversations rather than the very specific technical conversations, if you like.
So there's been people over time I've been interviewing on this show. Some people have said, look, KB, some people don't even get how the business works from a security point of view. They're just there to practice security. I think one person I interviewed a long time ago said that. I also had another lady on, I think she's from IBM, that said, you know, we're so focused on do people get cybersecurity, but does us as cybersecurity people get the business? What are your sort of thoughts on that? How do we sort of get these two worlds to talk to one another a little bit better and to understand where each side is coming from?
So I think if I go back to I'm doing some work around how do we train, I guess, new CISOs and get them to understand some of those aspects of what they need to lean into and train themselves to become to evolve into CISOs over time rather than, you know, spend 5 years learning it by experience. How can we give them sort of that step up? And I think if I was going to give advice to the most important skill to actually learn as a CISO, if you're not doing it already as a new CISO, is your communication skills. I probably spend the bulk of my time on a day-to-day basis just talking to people, anything and everything. I go into the office now, even though I can work from home quite easily, is because those hallways conversations are gold. And it may have nothing to do with cybersecurity. It's about building those relationships outside of IT, outside of corporate security, into purchasing, into finance, into the various business projects, both to understand better how they operate, what their pain points are, which may have nothing to do with cybersecurity, what they're planning to do sometimes, to build the connections so that it actually makes it easier. If they have a question, they're more comfortable coming to you and asking, saying, I want to go do this. What are the things I should be thinking about? Rather than turning up 6 months later on your doorstep saying, I want to go live. Can I go live with this? And it's a lot more painful to fix any issues that haven't been addressed. It's about building your network and your personal network internally within your organization, which the more you're spread across the business, I think the better you understand how your business operates. But it's also then building that network outside of your organization, not just across the cyber landscape, but if you can, outside of the discipline also to understand how other businesses operate. And that's where it comes back to, that takes a chunk of time. Building and maintaining your personal network is a lot of effort and takes a lot of time to do. But the value is you naturally will start changing the language you use, the way you talk, because you're not always talking to the same people, which is always a technical conversation.
So in terms of some of these hallway conversations that you have with people when you go into the office, is there anything that's sort of the common theme that you're hearing from other people across the organization in terms of HR or finance, that they're asking you stuff from a cyber perspective that's interesting to you? Is it more so they want to learn more so they can go to you to have that conversation? They don't think that you're going to judge them because they ask a silly question?
I always try to be the case of there are no silly questions, because obviously no one understands. I think right now, especially this year in the Australian context, obviously there's a lot of sensitivity around how we store and maintain private information. For our organisation, it's not really consumer focused. It's more about how do we protect the employee private information that we're custodian of, because they are employees, and obviously we have a fair chunk of private information regarding that. So are we doing right by our employees? Are we protecting them appropriately? What are our plans, I guess, in terms of the systems they want to do, whether it's digital transformation and therefore the concepts they need to think about when it comes to protecting that sort of information? I guess from our organization, it tends to be a little bit easier because we have by default been defense industry already a culture of understanding how to manage sensitive information. when it comes to national security information. So extending that out to the concept of we also have all these other sets of data sensitive information we should be considering and making sure we're doing it appropriately is a much easier conversation. But in many cases, it won't be those people coming to you and asking that question. It's great if they do and they are thinking about that. But to be honest, they're flat chat doing their job also. And they have exactly the same problem that we have, where they may not have the mind space to actually understand they need to be thinking about those concepts in itself, which is why if you're having those hallway conversations and you're talking about what they're doing and you're interested in what they're doing, you may actually get hints of where there may be problems, where then you can actually extend that conversation and say, hang on, you may have an issue here. Have you thought about this sort of aspect when it comes to the process you're doing or the data you're managing? Or if have you thought about it, and it may not be cyber because we are all technical, we may have a better technical solution to a process problem they're having, which has nothing to do with cybersecurity. So, and that gives, again, a different value to the conversation rather than being seen as, yes, we're always cybersecurity.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there I want to press on a little bit more. So great point around if you're talking to someone outside of cyber, there may be something that could become an issue, could be a risk there. Do you think that perhaps if you look at a traditional cyber team or even a CISO, maybe they're not doing that enough, so things are being overlooked? They're not asking people in other parts of, you know, even a casual conversation, hallway conversation, after work, doesn't matter. Those are the things, and maybe that's the devil's in the detail of having those conversations, that we are missing things as an industry because we're not just having a conversation with someone.
I think it's the case, and I think it's the case the more operational you are, and it doesn't have to be just cyber. It's the same problem from IT in general if you think about it, and it can probably go into other operational aspects also. If you're not having those conversations and you're just flat chat dealing with what's happening operationally on a day-to-day basis, and you see problems come in, problems come out, you see requests and demands come in, come out, you don't have time to really understand the business because you're so focused on your day-to-day work. And in many cases, those people, again, going back to, are you career-focused or are you just job-focused? Also, I guess, influence how much you want to spend understanding the business itself. Is a very diverse business. We do lots and lots of things, which is one of the reasons why I'm there. Because, yeah, the context which is I have to do on the day-to-day can be incredible sometimes from one thing to the other. So it's very hard to understand what the business is doing. And I've actually seen a journey where I've taken someone out of IT who she was in IT for the last 15 years, and her role was actually quite a bit of interaction with the business around service level, internal SLAs for IT support, dealing with problems when it comes to those harder problems with the business. So she had more touch points within the business than many people with IT. And I have given her a role as cybersecurity audit manager, and primarily because her superpower is stakeholder engagement, which is great for that role. Her learning journey and seeing her learning journey over the last 7-8 months as she's had to step in and do a number of audits and interact with the business at a much deeper layer, her understanding of what the company actually does on a day-to-day basis is totally different to what she thought of being in IT for the last 15 years. And she's a person who actually does lean in and have those conversations. But I think it's a case of unless you have the opportunity to spend the time to sit down and spend an hour or two and understand what a process does at a certain site or a certain business, it's very hard because everyone's busy.
So you raised some points before around not only do you have to build your internal sort of network within your company, but also externally as well. How do you sort of handle that for people that, and there's a lot of people in our space, as you know, that are very introverted. I would say I'm an ambivert, but that's been a learned skill over the years that no one ever believes me on. It's true, I never used to speak when I was a kid. I was so nervous. It was so strange that now I speak a lot. But I think I just started to understand that people that's kind of spoke more got further. So is there any sort of strategies or any sort of insights you can share, Ben, for people that are I'm nervous and I'm introverted. I feel scared. I feel I'm annoying someone when I ask them the question. Is there anything that you can share with the audience?
And I'm in very much the same position as yourself. I am an introvert and it's a learned skill that I talk so much. And this is where I started, probably 18 years ago, where basically I ripped the Band-Aid off and forced myself to do it because I knew I wanted to start talking about things. And there was a sort of an expectation also from an organization point of view to show that we knew how to do security given the space that we're actually in. So it was important for the organization also for me to play that role. So when I talk about, and actually a good story there is, and my whole team knows this, when I hire people, and it tends to be through internal anyway, I've had the benefit of being able to take most of my people from internal candidates. Part of the job interview, especially the second part of the interview, is I get them to actually do a bit of public speaking as part of the interview, where they have to prepare 2 5-minute presentations, one technical, one non-technical on the same subject. And in many cases, this is the first time they've ever really publicly spoken, even though it's within basically an interview. I mean, that's me, A, trying to rip the Band-Aid off a bit to say it doesn't have to be scary. It's a bit of how they deal under a stressful situation, because obviously it's the first time, it's going to be very stressful. So it's interesting to me to see how they react to stressful situations. But also it's very important for me, they need to be able to communicate to anyone and everyone. So they need to get over it. When I talk to people who are presenting for the first time or sitting on a panel the first time, it's very much a case of you need to get, they're afraid of stuffing up essentially. And the conversation I have with them is, you've already done the job, you're turning up. No one's going to walk out on you because they've come here to hear you. So there's nothing you can say that can be wrong. So at worst, they may be ambivalent about what you say, but they're not going to get up and start throwing tomatoes at you on stage. So just get up there and enjoy it.
I think that's a great approach in terms of the 5 minutes on the technical and the 5 minutes on the non-technical stuff, which you get to analyze how that person is and then grow them out of not being afraid. And then I think as well on the panel and all that sort of front, I think from my experience, people feel like they're being audited, like, oh, someone's going to catch me out. And I used to have this thing as well. And even on this show, Ben, like people come on here like, I don't know that answer. I'm like, it's not about the right or the wrong answer. It's just about your opinion, your experience on the matter. Because who knows it all? Like no one does. Like not, even when you're like 90 years old, you don't know everything, right? So I think it's just having these discussions so you can learn something.
Unfortunately, I think especially from an introvert point of view, I think the extroverts probably have it a little bit easier. But from an introvert point of view, getting to that place where you're comfortable is more got to do with maturity in your role and the comfort level you have in your role. And I've been very open talking about this year also, because I've been out and talking quite a bit, is I'm at the place because, especially given my tenure, is I'm not shy about my opinion. I've never been shy about my opinion. I believe that it's of value to everyone if I put my opinion out there. I'm not saying that everyone has to agree with it. I actually prefer that people don't agree with it, because they may signal I might be able to learn something that I had assumed previously. But even if I put that opinion out there, I'm not afraid of being wrong, because while people may debate my opinion, which I'm not scared of, they can't really debate my experience, which I can be comfortable in. And that's where I take comfort. How you get to that point, though, is, I guess, a very personal journey.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. And you're so right. You know, you've got a long tenure, even with Talus on its own. No one's going to question that. So I think that no, that's an excellent way of viewing it. So then the other sort of question that I have for you is, you mentioned we need to change the story on risk. So what's the current story?
When you think about the bulk of people, cyber people, and the exception probably is the finance industry don't do this, but they've got a bit of an advantage, I think. When you think about how we present risk, we always turn up and we say that, you know, this risk is red, this risk is orange, this risk is green. I always had the view that because it's such a technical conversation, and to be honest, the board or the executives don't really understand the nuances of the risks we're talking about, they can't interpret anything more than a red, orange, green, or a low, medium, high. And it was only when I sort of stepped back in and I stepped back into a quantitative risk framework last year, which I hadn't used for about 10 years, and started to understand underneath how it got created. And I was surprised when I actually dug into how they were actually doing the quantitative risk calculations and the history of the tools and the mechanisms they were using. I realized that some of those mechanisms have been used for the last 50 years in finance and project management, which means if you turn up and do a quantitative risk analysis on a cybersecurity aspect, you're no longer really telling up and saying, trust me, we have a red risk, you need to spend $500,000 to fix it. And really, the executive had nothing really to grab hold of to understand why, because they can't really understand the technical aspects of it. If you turn up and come up with a risk quantification distribution curve of the risk in terms of what the potential impact is, and you explain how it was calculated, i.e. it was calculated doing PERT tables that went into Monte Carlo simulations, they may not understand the technical aspects. They may not understand or really understand what drives the costs, but they've got something to grab hold of, which is they understand how you got to it from a maths point of view, because they've done it throughout their career history when it comes to potentially project management or finance, which means there's a greater level of confidence and therefore probably a deeper conversation we can have afterwards on where does that risk acceptance actually really live. I think we do ourselves a disservice at the moment by basically turning up to executives and really asking them to gamble on us and whether they think that we have the expertise to give the right sort of risk accountability and the amount of investment we need to fix it.
Yeah, okay, wow, this is really interesting. And so you said the last 50 years people have been doing and employing this in terms of the mechanics of how it works.
Even longer. So if you look at the history of Monte Carlo simulations that came out of the Manhattan Project in 1940s, where they were trying to do discrete maths, I think, to calculate the neutron path and decay of two nuclei, which if you're trying to do that with discrete maths is near impossible. And they found out using random numbers around the calculation and running tens of thousands of simulations, basically number theory comes out to be you get pretty close to the actual real answer. That's where Monte Carlo simulations come out of it. When you talk about PERT tables, it's funny enough, it comes out of the US Navy. I think it's in the mid-1950s when they were trying to get a better handle around doing the project management and the costings and the scheduling around building the Polaris submarine. There you go. I did actually remember from my research. So it's been around for a long time, and it's just because they're all so useful, then naturally, obviously, the Monte Carlo simulations per table moved into project management, but obviously then it's expanded out from there.
So what you're saying is, Ben, because of this Monte Carlo simulations, it's actually it's walking people through how they got to the answer rather than just here's the answer. Is that what you're sort of saying, like if you had to like a high-level sort of response?
No, because it's not even – I don't think that you'd go into the details and the specifics of what you fed into the Monte Carlo simulations to get the answer. I think it's probably comfortable enough for many executives to know that you use Monte Carlo simulations to run 10,000 or 50,000 simulations based on your best estimates of your minimum risk versus your risk impact versus your most likely versus your maximum risk impact. And this is the distribution curve we got in terms of cost impact because they understand how Monte Carlo works and how they feed it in their scenarios, whether it's project management or whether it's finance strategy and things like that. I think just the fact you're using Monte Carlo simulations provides the comfort that they can trust what you're saying a little bit more rather than just trusting you.
Yeah, okay. That is really interesting because, I mean, I've been in risk meetings before where you've got business risk, you've got tech risk, and they're like, we go through, I know the vulnerability or whatever it is, and then you've got these people like rating it.
Yep.
But then I'm like, sometimes I'm like, is this person even listening? Like, I swear at least one guy was watching television in the back and he's like, oh, like, so what was the update on that? What was the number? Oh, and then he like rated it really, really high. And we're like, what? I don't even think this guy was even listening. And then All of a sudden you've coming to an executive to say this, your stuff's in the red. And it's like, well, I don't know if we effectively measured that and did that properly.
The other good thing about quantitative risks, which I didn't really realize, but through conversations I've had this year, is if you're doing, and this, to be honest, within an organization, there's nothing wrong if you want to do and you're satisfied with using green, orange, red. The problem is if you're using risk ratings like that or low, medium, high, if you want to then compare yourself with another organization and they're also using green, orange, red, are you really comparing apples with apples? How do you know what they categorize as a red is the same as what you categorize as a red? The benefit of quantitative risk, it goes down to dollars. So it's very easy compared between organizations, potentially dollar impacts. So, and therefore you can start talking the same language when you actually want to compare one to the other.
Great point. Because I think even if you look at like business risk, what they care about is fundamentally different to like a tech risk, for example. Yeah. So is that a way in which you can align a little bit more on how both risk people approach the same problem? Because they're looking at it through the same lens versus, oh, you know, we're talking from a different angle?
I think so. And I think some of the harder things we have, I guess, coming from cyber in a technical sort of background and even SME engineering background is we like to be precise, but when we get into quantitative risk, one of the biggest stumbling points that people have is we don't have the data to feed into this, and they're very uncomfortable making a expert opinion on this is close enough, this is what I think it is, and they don't believe that the techniques used within quantitative risk will actually give them a real answer at the end, because it seems like guesswork at the beginning. So you're taking a qualitative assessment, i.e. an expert opinion in many cases, to get a quantitative figure at the end. And it's sort of until you actually do the work to understand how that works, it's, I guess, ourselves on the cyber point of view doing risks uncomfortable.
So I want to close off now, Ben, by asking, how do you know if you're employing purposeful leadership?
Good question. It's very much self-reflection. I think you have to think about the other aspects of purposeful leadership. Are you spending time to carve time out to do things that, while you may have 10,000 things that are high priority, and yes, you know leadership is important, or for example, I went into a bit of recruiting also, and how you actually recruit with purpose. Are you spending the right amount of time to do that, even though there's a lot of other things that on a day-to-day basis is probably just as important? And it's, if you're starting, I think it's the natural tendency that we'll do the more technical aspects of our role and the more risk-focused parts of our role, the more project review sort of concepts and policies and things like that, rather than spending the time to go work on ourselves as leaders, because I think we put at nationally at a lower priority than trying to deliver and get the outcome to the job that we're trying to do. I think in many cases, it comes back to many of us from a cybersecurity point of view, mission-based, if I use that term. So we want to complete the mission, which is to defend the company with our best efforts. And therefore, they will put those aspects in front of, I guess, your personal development, because we're missing the point that by becoming more purposeful leaders, we actually may be able to complete the mission a lot better and have a greater influence around that.
So, Ben, is there any sort of closing comments or final thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with today?
I guess it's just a case of think about where you are in your journey. Are you actually concentrating too much when it comes to the operational technical aspects? What are you doing to develop yourself? And if you don't have a personal network, if you do not communicate and have those conversations, then that should be probably your first priority.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.